money gets yanked from Greek banks.
But do officials have the power to do much about it?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, May 16th.
Coming up, the FBI starts nosing around J.P. Morgan Chase.
And how not to be like London Heathrow or Denver International Airports.
Plus the possibility that we will dress like kangaroos.
It's all just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
With a new general election on the way in Greece and the country's membership in the European single currency in the balance, people in Greece are trying to keep their bank accounts from losing value if ever the euro is dropped. Greece's central bank chief says depositors pulled about $900 million out of bank accounts on Monday alone. Joining me from Athens is the BBC's Richard Galpin. Good morning, Richard.
Morning to you.
What do we know about depositors taking their money out of bank accounts there?
Well, I have to say this was customers, ordinary customers, and some businesses. And that's just on one day. And obviously that was before the talks to try and form a coalition or national unity government had completely collapsed, and therefore Greece was going to move towards a second election. So if it does signal perhaps the start of some kind of run on the banks, that would be very, very worrying.
Have you actually seen any lines at banks above normal?
No, I haven't. But let's wait and see what happens today, because obviously we will have had a chance for people to have digested what happened with the collapse of the talks and see whether they are now going to react even more. You know, and obviously people have been taking money out of their accounts over the past couple of years, ever since the austerity measures. If the figures really start picking up, then we know we are into a situation with a run on the banks, which could lead to a default and exit for Greece from the eurozone very quickly indeed.
Is there anything that Greek authorities could do about this?
It's very difficult. One, they can try and reassure the population. And the other thing is to try and impose capital controls. But if my understanding is correct, then being part of the eurozone, they cannot do that legally. So it's only if they actually pull out, default and revert to the drachma, can they then start imposing capital controls to stop the flight of capital out of the country.
The BBC's Richard Galpin in Athens. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's get another take on this now with reporter John Syropoulos. He's also with us from Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, the term run on the banks is not something that we want to throw around lightly. So I want to ask you, what do we really know about all these bank withdrawals in Greece over the last few days?
There are no visible signs of a bank run. You don't see people queuing up at ATMs. There has been a very slow bank run over the last couple of years, during which people have withdrawn roughly a third of all household deposits from Greek banks. At the same time, there isn't a sense of panic, even though people are in a media environment in which the possibility of a bank collapse and a return to the drachma is constantly being discussed.
Are people feeling that they want to be closer to the euro going forward or that they want to leave?
Greeks have consistently over the last 2 years been polled as being in favor of the euro. It's seen as a great achievement for Greece. People are afraid that if we return to the drachma, the devaluation will reduce their savings to almost nothing. And I think finally, if you do declare a default on your creditors, the total debt would in fact multiply, because Greece's debt is configured in euros and dollars, and if tomorrow Greece were repaying that in a devalued drachma, it would take Greece forever to pay it off.
Reporter John Syropoulos in Athens. He blogs at thenewathenian.com. Thanks, John.
Thank you for having me.
The FBI is investigating possible criminal behavior at J.P. Morgan Chase after that $2 billion trading loss disclosed by the bank the other day, Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
Exactly how a trader at J.P. Morgan gambled and lost $2 billion is still far from clear. But a key question will be this. Was that multi-billion dollar bet a so-called hedge to balance out the risk of other investments? Or was the bank betting shareholder money for its own profit? The FBI probe is still preliminary. Bill Singer is a partner at Herskovitz PLC. He says the FBI may not even know yet what, if any, criminal charges apply.
You can't build a criminal case based upon quote-unquote public documents. You need informants. You need whistleblowers.
Singer says last night's anonymous leak about the FBI investigation could be intended to draw out potential whistleblowers at J.P. Morgan.
It's probably sending out a warning flare that if you want to come in and talk to us, do it now before we find you.
Meanwhile, at the bank's annual meeting in Tampa yesterday, CEO Jamie Dimon said his company's mistakes were, quote, unfortunately self-inflicted. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Vice President Biden is working to get the most political mileage out of the president's auto industry bailout. Today, it's a speech at an auto parts factory in Youngstown, Ohio. Ohio, because even though Detroit is in Michigan, the jobs that the auto bailout saved are spread across the Midwest. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Tractor trailers loaded with new Jeeps stream out of a huge Chrysler plant in Illinois. 4,000 workers will be punching in here by Election Day. In 2009, there were no auto workers left on the line.
I would think it would have been a huge mistake for America to give up this automobile industry.
Machine tool operator Bobby Cowan says some of his relatives are eager to get back to work at GM and Chrysler. Good news for Democrats, says historian Julian Zelizer.
They're hoping in Michigan and Ohio and parts of Pennsylvania, some sense that things are improving opens up places where Obama was seen as vulnerable.
Paul Eisenstein of the DetroitBureau.com says the bailouts aren't as popular away from the Great Lakes.
In Tennessee, with Nissan being a major factor in Detroit closing the Saturn plant, Senator Corker was one of the most outspoken opponents.
Eisenstein says opposition to the bailouts might weaken now that GM is ramping up production again in Tennessee. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Some good news on the home front this morning. We learned that housing starts were up 2.6% compared with last April. Home construction was up almost 30%. For more, let's bring in Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics. He's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what do you make of that? Up 2.6%, up 30% from last year.
Yeah, it's an encouraging sign. Keep in mind the housing market is a quilt, and this is one of the pieces of patchwork, and it's certainly something that you want to see. I think what's interesting is that builder confidence is at the highest level that it's been at in 5 years this month, which, you know, kind of gives you a sense of what the outlook is from the guys that are actually doing the permitting and starting the work. So we like to see that.
And I know that one of the big problems with the housing market all along has been that there's been too much inventory, too many houses out there on the market unsold. How are we standing when it comes to that right now?
So the good news is, what we've managed to do in this country is take the inventory of unsold homes down from 11-month supply to 6-month supply. Mm. And then when you add in something like this new permits and home starts number, you know, new home sales is 20% of the total home market. Every new home that gets built creates 3 jobs over the course of a year and generates about $90,000 in taxes on average. So it's an encouraging sign. It doesn't do much for the fact that we're still loaded with foreclosed properties all over the country. But again, let's take the good news as it comes.
And any sense at this point of what is causing this uptick in housing activity?
You know, I don't think that there's any policy that we can point to that's helping and that's making these numbers improve. I think it's a combination of ultra-low mortgage rates, the lowest ever, even though it's tough to qualify for a loan. Again, it doesn't hurt that borrowing costs for people that can't afford it are low. And then time. And time is really the essential component to any kind of boom-bust cycle when you're trying to work off the excesses. And it's been a long time.
Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Facebook is expected to begin selling stock to the public on Friday, a deal that could value the company at more than $100 billion. Today we're learning that more shares of the stock will be offered than originally expected. We're also getting reaction to the news that General Motors, one of the top advertisers in the country and the world, has pulled its ads from the social media site.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Eric Clemens, a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, why do you think GM would want to be pulling their advertising from Facebook at a time like this?
Well, I think there are several possibilities. The best for Facebook, of course, is that it's just a mistake from General Motors, which I think is the least likely. I've been joking in my class for years that you would not interrupt a best man speech to try to sell a car, that a social network is not a place to sell anything. And if that's correct, then this has just been ineffective, and we can sort of discuss why. Not quite so bad for Facebook would be if this is the wrong place to reach the Facebook demographic and that it really doesn't generalize. But my guess is that Facebook just isn't an advertising company.
And if that's true, that kind of undermines all these valuations of this company that we've been seeing.
I published a valuation estimate several weeks ago on the Huffington Post. And one of the things that was striking for me is that Facebook is 1,000 times larger than the New York Times, but has revenues only a third larger. Hmm. Now, it's hard to argue that somebody with 800 million users is a startup in the early growth stage, because if they multiply by 10, which is pessimistic for a startup, that's already larger than the population of Earth. So it's hard to say they're a startup, but they're certainly not yet an advertising company.
But I guess to play devil's advocate there are a lot of people, obviously, who look at Facebook and say this is a place where hundreds of millions of people spend their time, so there's some potential there to reach customers.
You know, I heard the same argument when Rupert Murdoch bought MySpace, and he said, you know, several tens of millions of people go to MySpace every day, and they're not buying anything. Think of how much money they're leaving on the table. And I remember laughing and publishing a short response in which I pointed out that, I don't know how many millions of Americans go to McDonald's every day, and yet we don't buy cars there or music or clothes. You know, there are places where we go to shop. There are places where we go to interact. There are places where we go to be amused, and we're trapped and we're forced to watch an ad. You know, increasingly movie theaters have figured out that we're not going to walk out, and they're going to show us ads at the beginning. But Facebook, by definition, is a place we go to be empowered. We don't sit there to watch ads, and when we're ready to buy something, we Google it.
I saw this great line today in reference to the initial public offering. It was an analyst at Greencrest Capital, and he said, this offering is no longer about the numbers, but, quote, this is much more a spectacle, a media event, and a cultural moment. You think there's some truth to that?
Well, of course there is. You know, I still have my ticket stubs from Woodstock, and I'm thinking I'd like to do a minimum purchase of Facebook shares, just not to be left out of the show, but to be a little more sort of supportive of Mark and the company. 800 million people is a lot. And if you think you're buying an advertising company, you're probably going to be disappointed. But if you think you're buying an option on the creative use of 800 million people, then you may be making a very smart purchase indeed.
Eric Clemens is a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. Professor Clemens, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Facebook's initial public offerings this Friday is going to make a lot of people rich, and many of them live in California. That could be some welcome news for the state's budget, as Ben Adler reports from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento.
It's budget season in California, which means there's a different rally practically every day outside the state capitol.
What do we want?
Childcare!
When do we need it?
Now!
This one was on Monday, the day Democratic Governor Jerry Brown released his updated budget proposal and informed Californians that the state was $16 billion in the hole instead of the mere $9 billion everyone expected. Several dozen people, including Jennifer Greppi, vented their frustrations over Brown's proposed cuts to welfare and child care grants.
These programs are how these families live and survive. It's really unfair to cut these programs.
With its huge deficit and years of cuts already in the books, California desperately needs some good news, as in money. And that's where Facebook's big stock offering comes in.
It's a really big deal.
Jason Cisney runs the budget numbers for California's nonpartisan legislative analyst office.
Because with the IPO, there will be a series of financial transactions beginning Friday that will generate a lot of taxable income for a few thousand Californians.
Particularly founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. he can end up paying the state hundreds of millions of dollars. Facebook's investors and current and former employees will face big tax bills as well. California's income tax on millionaires is 10%, second only to Hawaii. Cisne is projecting a one-time windfall of about $2 billion, roughly 2% of the state budget, with smaller amounts trickling in down the road.
It will not be a panacea. The state's budget problems are much bigger than this amount of money. But it's a real help, and it is a bright spot in the state's economy.
Cisne says the state could even net a billion or two more, depending on where the price of the stock ends up. In Sacramento, I'm Ben Adler for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
In Atlanta this morning, the world's busiest airport welcomes its first passengers to a brand new $1.4 billion international terminal. But Atlanta airport officials have two big fears. They're called Denver International and London Heathrow, where chaos ensued when new terminals opened there. As Jim Burris reports from WABE, Atlanta staged a dress rehearsal to keep that from happening.
So are you excited, Vogel, that you're going to the new international terminal?
Yeah.
On a recent Wednesday morning, the Anbil family drives from their suburban Atlanta home to Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport.
This doesn't look anywhere near the airport. Are we going the right way?
Passengers have to take a different interstate to get to the new terminal. That's enough to get even these frequent flyers lost.
It smells brand new.
When they do make it, Vogel, his father Nachu, and mother Mamata peer up at the impressive curved ceiling. Three-story tall windows let in the noontime sky. The Anbils are among 1,600 volunteers here putting the terminal to the test. The airport's given them a scenario to act out. It takes the family to the Delta Airlines counter to check in for a flight to Stockholm.
And keep in mind, it's not confusing. It may be big and beautiful, but it's not confusing.
The family gets their boarding passes and head to gate F8. Clearly, they are confused. They just kind of stop.
I don't know where I am, where I should go to.
The new terminal features a lot of curving pathways and expansive spaces. Nachu says it's tough to get your bearings.
For those passengers in the gatehouse on Delta's flight 9740.
Still, they're able to find their way to the gate, through customs, and baggage claim, all without hassle. That's just how Balram Biadari wants it. He's the airport's deputy general manager.
Sometimes the unknown tends to frighten us a little bit.
Biadari says most of the fake passengers had nothing but praise for the terminal. The only change the airport made based on the simulation was to tweak some signage in the parking lot.
On opening day, we're confident that all our system will work flawlessly.
The terminal's opening is 6 years behind the original schedule and twice the price cited in preliminary plans. But if Atlanta's airport wants to keep the title of world's busiest, it needs this new terminal to succeed. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Two big Hollywood movies hit theaters this weekend, Battleship and What to Expect When You're Expecting, one based on a board game, the other based on a book about pregnancy. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports, both films will leverage the power of strong brands.
Getting from this.
Battleship, Milton Bradley's great game of strategy.
B4 hit.
To this.
It's still unclear exactly what it was that hit Hong Kong.
Might seem like a stretch, but USC film professor Marty Kaplan says a lot of blockbusters have come from unlikely places. Pirates of the Caribbean was a ride at Disneyland. Tomb Raider was a video game. Kaplan says movie studios are hoping to leverage the value in those brands.
Movie studios will latch onto anything that already has some kind of recognition. I wouldn't be surprised if Chiquita Banana were the star.
Movie studios are doing this more because making money has gotten a lot harder, says Porter Bibb with MediaTek Capital Partners.
The aftermarket, which they counted on, the DVD business, is disappearing, and the international market is getting to be very selective.
Bibb says we can expect to see more familiar names and titles and maybe even some bananas on the big screen this year. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
And Jeremy, I don't know, remember this? When the iPad first came out, some goofy people would hold the thing to their ear and call it an overgrown iPhone, right? Because the two share all that software. But now there's where the iPhone could be supersized or maybe just enlarged slightly. The Wall Street Journal reports that some of Apple's suppliers in Asia say bigger screens have been ordered, presumably for the next generation phone. Quick, this is what we got to do. Design a jacket with a big kangaroo patch for the new phone in the front. We will be totally rich, I tell you.
Absolutely. They could sell it right in the Apple stores. Well, David, in St. Louis, someone dropped off a box of old Christmas stuff at Goodwill and accidentally left almost $15,000 cash inside. Well, Goodwill turned to the public for help, and boy, did the public respond. According to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, at least 15 people say they mistakenly donated the money.
Well, actually, I think I left some money over there.
No, I think it was me.
I can describe it perfectly.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.